Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
This week on the PR Moment podcast, I'm interviewing Brad McAfee, Global CEO of Port Novelli. Brad has worked at Port Novelli for the past 18 years and is now the global CEO of this Omnicom-owned PR firm. Port Novelli has 90 offices and operates in 60 countries. Before I start, I just wanted to make sure all our listeners were aware that the PR Moment Awards are now open for entries. New for 2019, all shortlisted work will get feedback on your entry relative to your competitors within the specific category. So check out the PR Moment Awards site where you can have a look at all the details. The first entry deadline is in December. Brad, welcome to the PR Moment podcast.
Oh, Ben, thank you very much. Thank you for having me today.
As CEO of an international PR firm, what do you see as the important growth areas for public relations right now?
Yeah, you know, I think there are a few, you know, and I'd like to mention four that I think specifically PR can own.
Right.
Right. And if you look at it, I think for us in particular, it's around purpose. Really, all that, all those campaigns that really help organizations not only with revenue generation, but also give back a little bit to society as well and connect their brands emotionally with consumers. So purpose, number one. We're seeing a lot overall on reputation management. Three is, you know, we're seeing more and more around policy, public affairs. And then finally, if you look at it, the employee engagement side. So okay. These four areas. Now, of course, that's always supported by integrated, fully integrated campaigns and digital for sure. But when you look at four big broad categories of what companies are coming to us and they uniquely find, if you look at the next several years, I think this is the area where PR owns and has the most significant ability to really navigate clients and help clients along.
Okay. Because I'm just looking at that. Reputation management, policy, employee engagement. I mean, they've been around for a while, right? Purpose is that the, you know, we've had this sort of rush for purpose, haven't we? I never know where I am with purpose. Is it the new CSR or does it go deeper than that? Are companies doing it well? Are some companies just doing a bit of greenwashing? Where do you see that?
I think it's fair because, right, even if you look at this area, it has been around for some time, but it's gone through some evolution,
yeah.
Right, from just philanthropic activities to cause marketing. But I think when you look at it more broadly, I think what organizations and brands that really get it, what they're looking at is they're saying that they understand, you know, based on some of the survey work we're looking at, that 87% of consumers will purchase from a brand that if they believe that they stand for something or take a stand on something. And just as interestingly, 67% of consumers will boycott a brand if they don't take a stand that they align with or don't agree with. So what you're seeing right now is more and more consumers are looking more deeply at the brands in which they engaged in and also the brands in which they purchase, they wear, that does it reflect me? And so purpose broadly is having all these different elements to it right now.
It's such an interesting area, though, isn't it? Because it included in purpose is, I don't know, convenience and presumably price and a whole load of other variables. Yeah. So you're sort of plugging purpose into that ecosystem of factors. Is that what we're saying? It's no more important than convenience or anything else. It's just another element to the purchase for brands to consider when people are purchasing their products.
I think that's broadly right. It's been elevated up to a point where consumers are doing their research and they want to understand what the brands are all about. So yes, they're looking at the quality of the product, the vision of a company, the innovation of a company. They want to know, are you doing good? How are you giving back? What does your supply chain look like? You know, and they're doing their research. And broadly speaking, they're also saying, this is important to me, and I hope that the brands that I purchase also reflect
sure.
my own values.
But in reality, it's about, I suppose, so if a company gets its product right and its price right, I'm oversimplifying
yeah,
this,
sure.
That the consumer will buy from them if they have a more beneficial purpose to that particular individual than an equivalent product that's also got its product, its price, and its workings of its product correct.
I think you've nailed it.
Okay. Now, what I love about the story of your career is that you've been in Portland Valley for 18 years.
Yes.
And it's a frequent theme, I guess, of this the Pyramid podcast that people in their careers never quite know when to stick or twist. And it's always a hugely it's an easier piece of analysis to do in hindsight, isn't it? So you've been there 18 years, which is a long time. Have you ever thought about leaving?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be unfair to say that I have never thought about leaving Porter Novelli. And I think, when I look at people today, when they're in their careers, every once in a while, there's a disappointment. And when disappointments happen, it can be a trigger event. So, Ben, to share a quick story with you, in 2006, I was up for partner. And I thought, for sure I'm going to make partner at Porter and Valley. I'd be pretty young to make partner at the time. And the five people were selected, and I wasn't one of the five.
Right.
And that was a bit of a shot, more to ego than anything. And then same year, 3 months later, I was up for a global position. And I was kind of informed, you're going to get it. Don't worry about it. Until I got the phone call that said I didn't get that position. Both those moments created this disappointment, which then had me questioning, am I with the right organization or not?
Did you say they were in three months? Yeah. Well, they weren't empathizing with you at that particular moment.
When I said it was an ego blow, it was a 1-2 shot.
Yeah.
But, I think that's not uncommon, I think, for all of us to go through those moments where I expected the promotion to happen at this time and it didn't. But I took mine a little further. I said, maybe I do need to leave. And I started thinking, do I start my own agency? Do I go in-house? What's next? And I started exploring all those avenues. And then there was a moment where I just paused and I said, reflect on the last, at that time, 6.5 years at Porter & Novelli. And I said, how's the company treated me overall? Was it a good opportunity for me? Was it not? And I decided to stay. I said, I'm going to give it another 6 months. And in that period of time, I was brought in as a partner. And then not within 6 months, but about a year later, I was promoted again to being a managing director of what at the time is the Atlanta office. And I reflect on that from time to time because it was just a moment where I said, don't be rash. And it was so pivotal from the standpoint of it was the lesson I learned. When I really considered why I didn't get those promotions, they were legitimately reasons.
You don't look back with a shrug. You look back and go, yeah, that was fair enough.
Fair enough. And not only that, but I learned something.
Okay.
Right? I learned something about myself. And their feedback in both cases was dead on. And when I changed that about myself, then I was able to get more opportunities. And I think sometimes when we're disappointed, we can't always hear the feedback.
Yep.
It's
interesting. I mean, we've all had those. I don't think any of us, especially when we're younger, I don't know, not any of us, but I certainly didn't, that career management, your own career management is such an important thing, isn't it? Because you're not going to get every move right, but if you get a few wrong on a trot, it does start to impact your earnings, basically, isn't it? And have an effect on where you're going to get to in your career, or it can do anyway.
It can. And then also then if you start to have a couple of situations on your resume, let's think of, when you start to look at hiring individuals, we see too many opportunities all in a row. Then all of a sudden, it doesn't mean that person's not perfect for your organization, but it may require more of a story to knit all those different experiences together.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Managing careers, I think, is a critical aspect of what we do in this industry.
Yeah. And I suppose the other bit, I was just thinking aloud on that, is that you we all have – how long it takes to when you're working for a firm to make a difference to that organization. You don't tend to make or massive impact on an organization in a strategic or management role anyway, for you know, 1 year is not going to cut it, is it? 2 years is probably not going to cut it. So at the senior end of things, if you look at – it's hard to say, well, I've made X, Y, Z contribution to an organization if you've only been there a couple of years. So.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things we look at is I would share with anyone who's starting a new job is what does that first 100 days look like?
Right. Okay.
Right. First 90 days.
So it's not just for the president. It's,
yeah. Well, but it sets the tone.
Right.
It sets the impression. Are you going to be driving impact on an ongoing basis? If you don't see something in those first 100 days, chances are you may not see something in 180 or 360 or 720, right? So you start to you do have to have an impact, but what is that impact? What can you influence early? And it doesn't have to be monumental, but demonstrating that you have that capability, I think, is critical.
It's a difficult balance, isn't it, actually?
Yeah.
Because if you go in there too hard,
right.
you can isolate yourself within what is in any organization normally quite a political environment. So it's a difficult balance to get. But I agree. Now, the network agencies seem to be a little unfashionable at the moment. I don't know. You're probably going to kick me under the table here and say, how dare you, Ben? But, you know, the relative growth anyway of independent agencies is fairly well documented, granted that it's much easier to grow a small organisation at a bigger percentage than a large organisation at a similar percentage. But you presumably reckon networked international agencies do have a really ambitious future.
I do.
Okay.
I do. And I know that might sound self-serving, but you know, and I'm happy to talk about independent agencies as well because I think quite frankly, both have really bright futures but for very different reasons. If you look at what's happening at some of the network agencies, there's a lot of great innovation and creativity happening. And some of that is able to be facilitated more quickly based on scale. So the amount of products that even at Porter Novelli that we're bringing out, new innovations, those are happening very quickly. The opportunities that we have to see some of the other experiences from some of the sister agencies within Omnicom is great. The diversity of thinking and thought from those organizations, the collaboration we have to create entirely new products is really, really good, and it benefits the companies in which we serve, those clients. If you take Bankside, where I'm spending this week with the team here in London, Omnicom has roughly 5,000 people in London, countless agencies in two buildings and a couple throughout the city. If you're an organization who's engaged with a holding company mentality or working with several agencies, you can come in and think of the power of that. All your agency partners you can meet with in one location, one time. When you leave, if you happen to be out of this country or out of the city, you know that you can still rely on that collaboration because all the proximity is helping that.
Right.
And you get that integration working and working in behalf of that campaign. I think that's really special. And you have more specialization within the holding companies to bring it all together. That to me is really exciting why the networked model I think is really, really powerful. And even though it may feel like there's a bit of a, I don't know, some perceptions right now in the market, I think ultimately you're going to see that scale, that diversity of skills and innovation being able to help brands and companies.
I'm just interested just to – because you said two – you sort of – you had two themes in that reply and I don't think they contradict each other but it would just be worth exploring, I think.
Sure.
It was around whether that nuanced public relations model was a sort of integrated offer plugging into lots of other elements or whether it became a specialist public relations function. And I guess it's kind of both, but just talk about how that works in practice, I suppose, because it's not always obvious how that, from a client's perspective, it's going to work from how you're going to put all those services together and if the client wants to put them all together.
Right, right. You know, I'll even take it a step further. Within Omnicom, we have Omnicom PR Group.
Yep.
So imagine you have 20 different PR brands that are all under this area called Omnicom PR Group. And what we're able to do for clients is mix and match teams to give the very best talent for the situation at hand. That becomes really powerful, and also because you may have some nuanced experience. So we may want to deliver an integrated campaign, but there may be a really different experience that one of our sister agencies like an RX Mosaic or Ketchum may have that we may not have as strong at Porter Novelli. You bring them together and knit them together to create an entire team and an approach for a client. And what clients are benefiting from is they don't have to say, well, we got 80% of the solution, that's close enough. Right. Now we can give them 100% of the team that they want.
And that's happening.
That's happening.
Not a plan. Nope. That happens right now.
Happens okay. Right now, and it happens frequently.
Okay.
And the other part of that that's powerful is we get more companies coming all the time saying, I want to have a global team. Well, in the old model, that means if I really want one global agency, I may have to say, okay, they're really good in London and in Dublin. They may be even really good in Brussels. But, you know, the team in Singapore or something may not have health experience, but I want that one team. So, you know, they're going to get there over time. Now, we don't have to do that. We can bring one of our sister agencies in and make sure that we have the best talent for that particular company and what's needed for that campaign, no matter where we are in the globe. That all of a sudden changes the game too, because you can get to that global solution, you can get to the integration, but you don't have to have any you don't have to forfeit any one market as being less strong. And to me, I think it's where you see the network model really providing a lot of value, stitching together a lot of independent shops. In that particular example, becomes really hard.
Okay, and where does that leave? Because I get that theory, right?
Yeah.
Where does that leave? And maybe it doesn't matter the individual brands like Port Novelli, Ketchum, Fleischmann, Hillard. Because in that example, you're sort of weaving more together for
sure.
The benefit of the client. But presumably, you're also passionate about Port Novelli as a brand itself.
Yes.
So. There is a tension there, isn't there?
There are, and there are different models for different companies that we're working with. And more times than not, it'll be driven by the particular client. We have some clients that say, I'm about talent. So we bring all that talent together, and they don't really necessarily have as much passion for the individual brand names.
No.
In some cases, they may have been working with Porter Novelli for 5-10 years.
Okay.
And we're bringing in others. And we might call it Porter Novelli Plus. And the Plus may be a representation of all the other partners who are coming in, but they still believe the engagement is first and foremost with Porter. So we have to be flexible to meet the specific needs of the client and the brands that are asking us to engage with them and what they really want to see from us.
Okay.
Some are going to be talent-based and some are going to be more brand-based.
Okay. Now, just coming out from the company perspective and looking at your personal story a bit more, when I was looking at your career history, one of the things that seemed to be a reoccurring theme was you being an advocate of putting employees first. And, you know, you can put any number of agency CEOs in a room and ask them their biggest growth limiting factor or their biggest challenge, and it's normally talents, either one or two, normally one. And you seem to have a history of putting employees first or prioritising that anyway. But how does that manifest itself in a PR firm? Because it's an easy thing to say, isn't it? But what does it actually mean?
Well, and let's also say it's not always really, really easy to execute,
okay.
If you want to know the truth. And so we're fortunate in that being part of Omnicom, we go to Omnicom University and we get taught this great model called the service profit chain. Jim Heskett and others came up with it years ago. And it talks about how if you really engage with the employees first and you can move them fundamentally up the engagement scale from being simply a loyal employee all the way up to being fully committed and act like an owner, that there's an absolute mirror effect on the clients in which you serve. And that as they see that happier employees and more engaged employees, they end up looking and they get this incredible service from those same employees. And the best part about it, and this is the crazy part, Ben, and I've seen it, you know, time and time again. If you get it right, and we don't always, but if you get it right, when you ask the client who's number one, the client says we are. If you ask the employee says we are. And if you get that really right, you don't have to really worry about the P&L statement. So it's really hard to execute, but it's as a philosophy, focusing on people, especially in today where there's so many different options for people, the gig economy and other options and choices that people could be making. I think putting time, energy, talent, learning and development, culture in place for people to learn, be inspired and grow on their job is something that we thrive for. And like I said, and trust me, you know, if you had 20 people here from Porter Novelli, they would say, you know, we're a work in progress. On our best day, we do it well. And on many days, we're aspiring to do better than what we did the day before.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. You're never going to reach the end of that journey, are you? It's always going to be work in progress to an extent. So it's just – and I know this is an impossible question, but you know, I'm always intrigued about what actually that – what are the successful elements to that? Because, you know, people get a massage on a Friday or have a – there's a beer trolley that goes round. You know, those are almost – you know, they're not going to cut it in this day and age, are they? They're almost hygiene factors now.
Yeah. I think, you know, part of this now as well is the expectations change more and more. More people – more employees are looking for experiences. What is it – what's my experience like when I come in each and every day? The experience of the overall – you said it, the overall culture. What is that like? Is it a political culture?
Yeah.
Is it a supportive culture? What are the values of the organization? How are they supported? What are the other experiences?
The work.
What's the work experience? Yeah. What am I engaged in with my clients? Do I believe in that work? Am I making a positive impact?
It's almost as simple as having happy employees. You know, guess what? You know, things don't change, right? That's the key.
Okay. Yeah.
And I suppose a bit of that is there is definitely a culture, and it's less so now than it was, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, of PR firms being just saying yes all the time. Do you know what I mean? So that puts so much pressure on employees, doesn't it? So trying to get that balance right, I guess, is important.
Oh yeah, I will tell you. You know, one of our values is stand up for the right idea, but some of that also means. There's some ideas that we probably shouldn't execute against, not just at Porter Novelli, but maybe the brand shouldn't execute against this either, the client that we're serving. And giving some level of permission to be a great, solid consultant, know that we have our employees' backs, I think is important.
Okay. Now, I'm always interested about that sort of holding company. So from a management perspective, what's it like working for a holding company?
You know, it's actually, as I mentioned before, and I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture. I mean, it's a business like any other business. The holding companies are publicly traded. So, of course, you're going to have a focus on making sure you're driving good business and good business outcomes for your shareholders, in our case, the holding company and managers. But I like what they create within the holding company. That's where I get excited. And, you know, I talked about Omnicom PR Group. This Omnicom University, emerging stars, which we have all these different experiences for engagement, and then you also get pulled together. So the collaboration between agencies is really, really interesting, and you get together, and you start to think, what do you have for measurement? We have this for measurement, and you start just brainstorming, what would that look like if we collaborate together? Could we do something new and different and breakthrough in the industry? And these holding companies, you know, and I'm partial to one in particular, but they have so many different skills and so many different capabilities.
And resource.
And resource. And so if we come up with a new innovation, there's Omnicom marketing technology that can help us bring an innovation to life. I mean, those are things that we might not be able to afford as a single agency, but part of a larger organization, a holding company like this is great. And the collaboration's great in terms of collaborating to win together and seeing what different agencies you can bring together for the best solution for a client and how that client sees you differently.
It's difficult because you're still rivals, aren't you? I mean, you're frenemies, but do you often pitch against the Omnicom firms? The old WPP model was if they get a few firms in on the pitch list, it's a good thing. So I assume the same is true for Omnicom, is it? Is
that? I would say that we do from time to time, for sure.
Right.
It has been more of a shift lately, especially from on the PR side of if there's two or three of us in, would we be a better one together?
Yeah.
And I know that sounds crazy, but the number of times we have on behalf of some really, really interesting brands said, we're going to have Ketchum manage the U.S., we're going to have Porter Novelli manage U.K. and Europe for this pharma company, and collectively we're stronger together and we win.
Right.
It's great for the holding company. It's great for our team who wants a win. And maybe individually, maybe we wouldn't have been strong enough to win it together, but collectively we are. It doesn't always go that way. Sometimes we look and say, we both are really strong. Why don't we both go in and go after this piece of business? But more and more times we're at least saying, is there a different way of looking at this opportunity?
Okay. So it's quite a close relationship, just going back to my question, with Omnicom.
It is.
You know, it's not like they leave you alone for a quarter and then say, right, Brad, what are those numbers looking like? I get the feeling it's a bit more than that.
It's a lot. You know, giving another example, tomorrow evening, one of the reasons I'm here is we're having a 100 event.
Right.
And the 100 is a collection of Omnicom agencies who have come together around purpose for nonprofit foundations and even corporations looking at purpose. And so it includes Portland and Raymond Martin and Fleischmann, Ketchum, Porter Novelli, Critical Mass, Interbrand, BBDO. And these organizations come together and we collectively market our capabilities when it makes sense as 100.
Right.
And so tomorrow there's a CEO event, and we're having great speakers, and so we do that kind of thing all the time because we do believe we're better together.
Right. Okay. Now, lots of people have an ambition to become a CEO of a big PR firm, but not that many people realize that ambition. How did you become CEO?
Well, you know, I was very fortunate in throughout my career. Karen Van Bergen was the CEO at Porter Novelli before I was. She was promoted up to this new group called Omnicom PR Group as the CEO. And I was at the time overseeing our North American operations. And she just asked me. She said, what do you want? And you know.
Makes sense.
It felt like it. But I will tell you, it's only a little humorous in the rearview mirror because about a month and a half prior to her asking, I had told a colleague, I don't ever intend to be a CEO of an agency, right?
And then fortunately, you hadn't told Karen,
right? Yeah, yeah. Thankfully, I didn't tell Karen because she would have remembered that.
Yeah.
But no, you know, sometimes you're in the right place at the right time.
Okay. So. But it's the type of roles you'd had previously. You obviously were MDs at various offices within the States. What was your first MD job?
Atlanta.
Yeah. But what was your sort of vertical area of specialism? What's your home turf, so to speak?
Technology.
Okay.
Technology. So I grew up in the tech industry. I was actually at one agency called Copthorne & Bellows that was purchased by Porter Novelli.
Right.
I was there for a period of time. I left, went client side, and then I came back. And when I came back, I joined as Porter Novelli. And so was in tech, and you know, it's interesting. Just on Thursday, I was meeting with a young gentleman at Porter Novelli, and I asked his career ambitions, and he looked at me and says, I would like your job. And, you know, and what was interesting, I said,
you say, get back in the books.
No, I actually looked at him and I said, well, let's plot it out. Where are you right now?
Right.
And so, you know, some of those things that I would say to anyone who has any kind of ambition like that is, how do you get to know your organization inside and out? P&L responsibility, management of global accounts, Are you working, you know, in any of the service lines that your organization may have? How do you get a broader scale of the organization? And I had those global opportunities. I had North American opportunities. I had local opportunities. I had opportunities to manage several offices at one time.
Okay.
And I think all those things kind of add up. And you look at each experience and you say, is this going to build to something or not?
It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because I have had that conversation a number of times. That in the really good PR people, assuming businesses are a meritocracy, which they normally are, and rightly so, end up having big management roles. And it doesn't always have a happy ending, does it? But what you're sort of saying there was that there were various different elements which you felt you developed over the years, management skills around doing the actual work and various other bits and pieces, that financial, which meant that sort of built, prepared you for that.
Yeah, I would say it's that. And then the other element, and this is where personally I was fortunate, but I think anyone who has this kind of ambition, you need great mentors along the way, right? You need people that may see something in you and they start to look and they say, let's get this individual an experience here or there. Let's put them into this university setting so they learn a little bit more, right?
And for you, that was always within Omnicom. You didn't go and find a mentor outside of the company that you had a separate relationship with?
Yeah. I was fortunate. I had really, really great people within Porter Novelli, who really helped me on my journey and still do, and within Omnicom. So I've been very, very blessed in that way. And then had a couple of people in my previous, client side relationship who have still helped me and helped guide me in terms of how to be a better manager. And so you look, certain people are going to give you different types of experiences.
So it wasn't one.
No,
it was
no.
And did they know they're a mentor? Do you know what I mean? Because people are probably a mentor to me, but I'm not sure they know it. Do you know? Because it's not always a formal relationship, is it? It's quite interesting.
No, I think what you just said is so important. I will say some know that they're my mentor, and some to this day may not know. I look for moments to kind of let them know how much I appreciate them for sure. But I look at some of those moments, and the best mentors, in my opinion, are the ones that tell you things that you actually have to hear. Maybe not that you want to hear.
But you're right there. You take different things from different people, don't you? So there's one guy who's, I think there's elements I definitely don't want to take from him. But there's some things. He does that well. Right. So it's quite it's interesting how it's kind of like a jigsaw, isn't it?
Yes.
In some ways.
Yes.
Okay. You've been in public relations for over 20 years. How's the business changed in that time, do you think? Because I always think there's a temptation to think that we live in, it's very fashionable to say there's more change next year than there ever has been ever before. Do you know what I mean? In reality, that's not true, is it? But it's the market has changed. I wonder if the speed of change is increasing to the extent that everyone likes to say it is.
I think the speed has certainly never been faster. And if you look at the last several years here, take the last five, take the last 10, that the amount of change in our industry just in those increments of time is incredible. If you look at but probably more in the last 10 years than there were probably in the previous 20 or 30, if you look at it. And so, I look at some of those things and I think, broadband communications. What a game changer that was for our whole entire industry, right? Websites, the ability to look at true digital campaigns, social campaigns, and then mobile campaigns, and what it's like to reach people whenever you can and wherever you want to, and then the need for skills around analytics and data. And how you can use that data to actually help you with your campaigns. So when I came out, and Ben, maybe much like you did when you started in the industry, you had to be a good writer. You had to be resourceful. And please, it would be wonderful if you could pitch. now we're hiring people, from all different walks of life.
Yeah.
Some with really, really deep expertise in specialty areas. And in some cases, the generalist. But the generalist now – They know design and layout. They know analytics. They know social. They've done social. They're writers. I mean, so much of the skills that they have now are so different than what we had. So I look at this and think it has to all work together, but it also has to work because that amount of change that's coming, we've got to be very flexible. We've got to be forward thinking. We have to adapt faster than before. It's one of the reasons why, not to belabor an answer, it's one of the reasons why I always like to have a few early stage clients at Porter Novelli or startups or emerging tech companies, because you know some of the larger brands want to make sure that some of the new technologies or the new channels or the new ways of reaching the consumer are tested and tried. And you look at some of the newer organizations coming, they're more willing to try new things because they have to do different, they have to stand out. And so I think you always need to have a stable of clients that are really out there and pushing the envelope so that your people are constantly trying new things and yeah. Pushing themselves.
It's interesting. So you need to make choices about your portfolio of client work to help you keep moving the type of what you're doing on.
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, I just, as you were saying that, just made me think. So a lot of the stuff I thought you mentioned there in terms of the method and the practice yeah. of public relations has changed, hasn't it? It's changed a lot. But has the reason that clients hire a PR firm changed?
You know, I think the core stands pretty solidly, right? And it's one of the things that one of the very first questions he asked me is about, you know, where is it all going? And I think, you know, reputation has always been key. You know, being able to tell your story, do it in a very, very sound way that connects with the brand, connects emotionally with consumers. That's always been there. Policy, public affairs, been there. Engaging with employees is where, you know, PR is getting way more active in employee engagement than it's ever has. And purpose, you know, so I think some of those things are core. But I think within that has been where some of the change has been. It's the how. So you still do get a number of companies saying, we need real strong digital talent. We need real strong social talent. We need to reach companies or consumers in different ways. And so what you're seeing is within that, there might be a lot of change and a lot of difference. But, you know, broadly speaking, agencies are still brought in to do a lot of the things that we've been doing and what we're really strong at doing for years.
Okay. And as part of your role is – well, your role is obviously a global one. Global is an interesting word, isn't it, from a PR agency perspective, because few campaigns are actually really global. They tend just to be multi-specialist in terms of the markets they're in. So I'm just wondering, what is – with a global angle, what does your role look like? Where are you placing your greatest emphasis or trying to spread yourself?
Yeah. Well, you know, we participate either directly or through our partner network, you know, across the whole entire globe. And we really need to be there for our clients, and we need to have an offering there for our clients whenever possible. And Ben, you're absolutely right. Different markets might be in slightly different adoption or might be in different parts of the engagement with brands. And so maybe you have an overarching campaign, but maybe the execution looks different from location to location. For me, Europe is a growing force for Porter Novelli, so I continue to look more and more here. Our Latin American network is about as strong as it's ever been, and I'm really excited about that. Of course, our core, still where the majority of our business is in North America, and you know, Asia continues to grow. So you look at those things, and you've got to have focus on each and every one of them. But right now, we're seeing a lot of opportunities when it comes to purpose, being in North America and in Europe, predominantly.
Okay. I suppose that just leads on to a follow-up question on your role in that. So,
yeah.
are you Do you do a lot of client work? Are you mainly on strategy? What's your are you hand on the tiller? What does that global CEO role look like in a global PR firm?
Yeah, interesting question. And so, we have a model at Portinavelli that everyone on our global executive committee, which is about 10 people, they will have oversight or drive various different clients.
Right.
So I have about 3 clients that I am accountable for. I mean, ultimately, you can say I'm accountable for the success of all of it, but as CEO, but specifically 3 that I'm actively engaged in, and then I get brought in on various different things. If it's new strategic direction, maybe something on purpose, or if it's focused on an M&A, I may or a crisis, you may see my involvement increase, but almost 100% of that time, I get engaged so that we can make sure that we have the right resources for that particular client at that particular moment, whether that's Portinavelli resource or anywhere within the Omnicom network.
Okay. Now, just a bit of a change of tack. I was looking at Giving Tuesday in the UK, which I know is something you guys are very passionate about and you're involved with over here. Presumably as a PR firm, there's a whole raft of these types of projects that you could support.
Sure.
And it's difficult to choose which one you're going to support, but you decided to go with Giving Tuesday. Yeah. Why was that?
Well, it's interesting. Giving Tuesday, if you look broadly, is in its 7th year.
Right.
Something that was founded by Henry Timms, CEO of 92nd Street Y, but also the author of The New Power. If people haven't read it, it is worth a read. It's really, really, really strong. Came up with this idea of what does it look like if you had a day of giving 7 years ago? Think about that. I mean, it's pretty impactful here in the UK. It was 2014 where it really got adopted. It's now in 60 countries.
Wow,
60 countries. That's fantastic. And so here's what I think is the big shift that's happening with Giving Tuesday, and I'm excited about it. And that is, it at its core, a lot of nonprofit or cause related organizations jumped in and said, "Hey, this is really a great kickoff to end of year giving season, holiday season. Participate by giving back a little bit and asking, individuals to help fund and raise some money." And it's really, really good. What we've seen in the last couple of years, and I will tell you, this is going to be one of those turning point years, and next year is going to be incredible, is brands are getting involved. Because oftentimes these brands, these companies have philanthropic partners, they have causes that they care about, and they have scale. They're engaged with their consumer audiences in various different ways. And what we're seeing is unique type of campaigns coming up where organizations can use that scale and say, "Help us raise money for these funds or these organizations or that organizations because they're important to our organization and you're a consumer of our organization." That all of a sudden shifts the whole dynamic of what is possible. So if you think of last year in the U.S. alone, $350 million were raised for causes. That's what's tracked. That's probably going to be more than $1 billion this year. So as an organization, as an agency that cares about purpose, cares about cause, cares about helping organizations connect more deeply and richly with consumers and helping really good causes get the funding they need to make a greater impact in society, we quite frankly didn't want to have another year on the sideline. We wanted to be in.
Okay. Now, just to finish with a serious topic, one around diversity. Why do you think it is that PR firms and to a lesser extent in-house teams don't better reflect the society within which they operate?
It's an important question. I'm glad that you've raised it here. I think there's a couple things. You have to look at this as a moral imperative. You have to look at it as a business imperative. It has to be both. I think the expectations now are so much higher than they've ever been in terms of what organizations are asking, whether it's of their in-house team or whether it's organizations asking of their agencies. What they're asking for is we need a breakthrough campaign. We need to cut through the clutter. We need something that's innovative. And I just don't fundamentally believe that putting a room full of all like-minded people is going to get you to that breakthrough. Diversity matters. It just does. Bringing different people together, different backgrounds, different experiences all coming together, that's when that those intersections can happen. And then that's when we all end up turning around and saying diversity drives innovation. Diversity drives creativity. So what you've also seen in about the last 2 years, and you know, I'm happy to give Antonio Lucio, of formerly of HP, now the CMO of Facebook, a lot of credit for this, and he got other CMOs on board, is he put a mandate out to agencies.
Mm.
And he said, I want to see diverse teams. I want to see that reflection of my consumer back to me when I'm looking at my in-house team and my agency team.
So, and if you don't have that, you ain't going to get on the pitch list.
You're not going to get on the pitch list. And it shouldn't have, in my opinion, it shouldn't have taken that.
So when did that happen?
That happened in the fall of 16.
Okay. So that enough time has passed now for that to have taken effect in the U.S. anyway.
Yes.
And has it had that moment of change?
Yeah. So I think there's been a lot of progress.
Right.
There's been a lot of progress. Are we there yet? Absolutely not.
Okay.
You know, one of the things that we've got this great diversity and inclusion leader, global leader, Nin Soon-Mi Kim. She worked directly with the PR Council in the States to get organizations, agencies in particular, to sign a pledge around diversity and inclusion. To really, let's make a difference. Let's make an impact in our own industry.
Okay.
And it was pretty much a reflection of what Tim Ryan, the CEO of PwC, has done on a global basis, encouraging CEOs to take a pledge and say, hey, we need the whole entire Fortune 500, global 1,000 companies to really commit to diversity and inclusion.
Okay. Because, I mean, listen, I'm less familiar with the progress in that respect of diversity in the US. In the UK, there's been a huge amount of conversations around it. I am less convinced that we've seen a huge amount of change, but maybe it's naive to think of huge amounts of change within 2-3 years, if you see what I mean. Maybe it's going to take longer. But I wonder what are the – seems to me that you're right. Driven by the buy side seems to have had a big effect in the US, doesn't it? And it would seem sensible for that to happen more widely in different global markets. Are there any other things that you think have really worked?
I think there's – you have to – if you really are committed, you have to measure.
Okay.
You have to measure, right? You know, so you know, when we look at our organization, we measure. And I know, you know, roughly 3/4 of our organization is women. I'm not sure that is absolutely perfect. That doesn't necessarily reflect the division of the global population. But more importantly, more than 50% are in leadership roles. And then you start breaking it down from there. You know, I can tell you that more than 50% of all managing directors are leading females. But I also can point to you and say number of people of color that are managing directors in our organization. We look at it in terms of who are we bringing in. We also look at it from what do our slate of candidates look like.
Exactly. Right? That's where it gets hard, right? Because you're not always select the audience of candidate. The candidate list may or may not include the sectors, the types of people who you would like it to include. And that becomes then quite difficult to manage, doesn't it?
I think the key part there is that has been, I think, widely used as an excuse, if I can just say this, because we end up saying, well, the pool of candidates weren't that good, so therefore this is a reflection of the agency and the hires that we've made. I think there's some things we can do as an organization. First, always be recruiting. So, you know who all those top talented individuals are of all backgrounds.
Right.
Because the thing and I'll say this for agencies, but probably similar for in-house teams as well, is when you have an opening, there's like this urgency.
Yeah.
Fill that role as soon as you possibly can. And, you know, the first person comes in with hits the remit, it's like get them on board, get them billable. I think the better thing that we need to be doing is making sure that the slate of candidates is wide, it's broad, it's focused. And here's the thing that I will say. When we have done that, the best candidate is the candidate that is selected. And in that case, you would imagine.
But you might have to carry that salary for a while, if you see what I mean, because that what you're saying is the time between the vacancy happening and the candidate being available may not be exactly the same. So therefore, you if you're always recruiting, you have to swallow that salary to an extent, to whatever degree, over for a period of time until that you win that business or whatever else.
I think when you're always recruiting. When you're always recruiting, it doesn't mean you make the hire at the moment in time.
Okay.
But what it means is you always know what that diverse slate of candidates is going to look like for each level and each job that you have.
Okay.
I think what happens is when you start from scratch, then that's when we get into some poor habits of hire the first person that hits the job description.
Okay.
And there are better ways of doing that if you want a true diverse staff.
Sure. But your measurement point's important because what you're saying is if certain trends start going the wrong way, then it flags it and you can frankly do something about it.
You can do something about it and not just do something about it. But the great part about having goals, the great part about having measurements is that everyone then sees – in the organization what you're doing. So then that starts to create the culture around diversity and inclusion that you want. And people start making more referrals and they say, you know, I met somebody who's really great and the candidate that should be a part of Port Arthur Valley. And ultimately what you want is the greatest list of candidates you possibly could get from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all experience levels. And then let the very best person get hired. And if you do that and you do that consistently, you will end up with a diverse staff.
And I suspect I know what you're going to say to this question, but you presumably believe that when you have a more diverse team working on a campaign, you get a better result.
Absolutely. Okay. I just fundamentally believe it. And what's interesting, we started doing a little bit of research on that in particular. And I'll tell you, some of our most diverse teams had the greatest amount of growth for Port Arthur Valley.
Oh, really?
But also probably had some of the best success for the client. And so we dive into this because when – you know, I think it was for years companies said, well, it's a business imperative. But make it a business advantage, right? And for us, you look and you say, we can do this and we're – much like I talked about with an employee-first mentality, this is a work in progress. And we're nowhere near where we want to be on this journey. We could have a more inclusive organization. We can have more diversity for sure. But I think if you commit to it and you lean into it and then you have programs and implement unique ideas around it, then it's not just, you know, talking it, but you walk the walk as well. And I think that part's important.
Brilliant. Brad, thank you very much indeed.
Yeah, thank you, Ben. I appreciate it. It's been a fun conversation, enjoyable.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.